Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to another unbelievable classic replay. I'm Ruth Jackson, and this week we're delving back into the archives to bring you a discussion on the question.
Get the grey matter thinking today. Is our mind more than matter?
Let's jump in on today's discussion.
Well, first of all, a warm welcome to you, Keith. It's been a long time since we had you on the programme. I think the last time talking about things like theistic evolution and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's some time back.
But you're back with us today, and we're talking about the area of philosophy of mind. Is the mind more than matter? But tell us a little bit of your background. You're a Christian philosopher, and you've pretty much been in this area all of your academic life, really, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I was a philosopher before I was a Christian, I should say. I started off as somebody who was agnostic, I think would be the right word to put it, and came to think on philosophical grounds that it was plausible, I find it plausible anyway, to see that mind or spirit was more fundamental than matter. And so given that view, I got interested in religion, and that went on, and I got involved in a church, and I became a Christian. So
right. I mean, it's interesting, obviously, one can imagine a form of philosophy persuading someone for a form of theism, but it's quite a step further to go to Christianity, per se, and the claims that that makes.
Well, that is true, and a lot of people say that. But on the other hand, straightforwardly, Christianity is just the most obvious thing around in parts of England that I've lived in. So you come across it fairly rapidly. Also, I do think it's true, Christianity is probably the most philosophically interesting religion. I mean, it might sound a bit naughty to say that, but I think it's true that most philosophers that we know about in the Western tradition, which gives the game away in a way, have been Christians or interested in Christianity, or that's been the background to their talk. So it's a very natural thing to look at.
Well, we're talking about the philosophy of mind today, and is it fair to describe you as a dualist? Is that the kind of position that's...
I accept that term, but people hate it so much that you feel perhaps I should call myself something else. And so something that I do call myself is a dual aspect idealist. So the dual aspect modifies the sort of dualism which says, as Plato did, you know, the soul is completely different from the body.
But essentially you do believe in an immaterial part of who we are, in that sense.
Yes, I do. Again, the phrases are a bit difficult, but yes, I do.
well, we'll come to that. We'll nuance this as we go along, obviously, and come to it. David Papineau. I tried to make sure I got this right before this programme began, and I've now stumbled on it. But David, thank you for joining us as well. First time here on the programme. You're Professor of Philosophy of Science at King's College London. How long have you, as it were, been dealing in this particular area of the philosophy of mind and been interested in it?
I came to philosophy of mind quite late in my philosophical career. I started off as a philosopher of science. Well, I started off when I first went to university as a mathematician, and I was a math student for 4 years, and then I switched to philosophy, and I worked on areas in philosophy of science, understanding the structure of scientific theories, nature of social science, and I'm just trying to think. I worked in epistemology for a long time, and I only became interested in in what I think of as metaphysical issues, the nature of reality, quite late in my my philosophical career.
And would you describe your worldview as having been atheistic all your life in some sense?
Yes, I've never came across religion at all very much as a young person. My parents were both straightforward atheists. My mother was Jewish. My father, I guess, was from an Anglican background, but there was no religion in my upbringing at all. And so it went on, rather. I've never had really...
And you've never been at all tempted to think otherwise in the course of your sort of philosophical journey? I mean, I don't know how much it would have necessarily...
Absolutely brought... not. I've never seen any reason to change my atheist mind at all. I'm sorry, it's something of a surprise to me, the extent to which, when I was young, I was expecting everybody to come round to my way of thinking. And it's a great surprise to me that the world has moved in a different direction.
Right, yes. Well, in the sense that religion, and certainly perhaps not in the Western world necessarily, but certainly other parts of the world, is increasing.
By my counting, it's pretty much increasing in the Western world.
Yes,
as well, or at least not decreasing as fast as I might have expected.
Well, that's an interesting sort of aspect to, I suppose, the cultural side of religion. But in a sense, do you still see philosophy as predominantly dominated by a sort of atheistic outlook? I mean, is Keith the sort of person who's in the minority in that sense in the philosophical world?
I suppose Keith's in the minority, but again, not nearly as far as I would have expected 40 years ago when I started doing philosophy. I expected all the Christians, religious people to disappear.
You stick around? Why haven't you Christian philosophers disappeared, Keith?
It's very odd, really. I remember Freddie Eyre, who was, of course, a very famous atheist and professor of philosophy at Oxford, being utterly surprised that his successor in the chair at Oxford was Michael Dummett, who was a very traditional Catholic, and he really couldn't understand how that had happened at all. But there are quite a lot of Christian philosophers. I think we are in a minority, but it's quite a strong minority, and the Christian philosophers group, which is now called the Philosophy of Religion group, is probably the best attended philosophical society in the UK and in the States too, really. So, I mean, obviously, it is a bit of a surprise to me
too. Just while we're on the sociological strain, so we're going to be talking about materialism and dualism and so on in a moment, but there are plenty of philosophers who are not religious in the Western world, not Christian, but nevertheless have anxieties about materialism, hankerings for something transcendental, and that's a rather wider group than the officially Christian philosophers. And again, I'd say they're probably in the minority, but not by a long way. I mean, it's not like 5%, it's more like 30%, 40%. I mean, there is, in fact, there are surveys done by some philosophers, in particular, very eminent dualist David Chalmers, has done a survey of how many philosophers are materialists, how many atheists, how many... And the anti-materialists are surprisingly, given my earlier way of thinking, surprisingly large group.
I agree with the fact that you could be an anti-materialist without being religious at all. I mean, that's perfectly possible. But it's harder to be religious and materialist, I think.
Yes, well, obviously, I mean, is that what you would describe yourself as, a materialist, David, in that sense? You believe there is nothing else than matter in the universe. There's nothing more than matter, as it were.
Yes, but be very careful. When I say that, I don't mean to deny that there are many... that most of the things that we recognise in common sense and take to be important, like consciousness and moral value and freedom and so on, I don't deny the existence of those things. I just think that they're part of the material world. We don't need to posit anything.
They arise from the material world.
I wouldn't even want to say arise from, because that sounds like they're different, that the material world somehow generates some extra fancy stuff. I just want to say they're part of the material world, just as you might not have realised that viruses are material, that simple animals are material. Now you realize they're just part of the material world, but I think we're just more complicated versions of the same thing. But of course, we are conscious. Certain things are valuable. We do often act freely. I don't want to deny that. I think that materialists have got to understand the real nature of those phenomena. They don't want to deny the existence.
Right. in a sense, this is part of your argument for the supernatural, for God, indeed, is partly based on the evidence you find for an immaterial mind. So lay the case out for us, for the immaterial nature of ourselves.
Talking about the immateriality of the mind is not necessarily connected with talking about God, though it is true that once you begin to say that consciousness and value and purpose are objective elements of reality, then it's very natural to think there might be a supreme mind somewhere.
It's certainly consistent God. With that.
Certainly consistent. Consilient is a good word, I think, would be consilient with that. Well, why? I suppose I began myself from a very traditional British empiricist position in philosophy, namely that all knowledge begins with experience. And it's a thing which is commonly said. But it leads you to think that perhaps experience is the foundation of knowledge, and if it's the foundation of knowledge, then nothing that you go on to say about knowledge is going to undermine that foundation. So if you start with things which you think are direct elements of experience, they're going to be fundamental elements of reality. So I think that's a basic philosophical question about your starting point and whether you should start there. In fact, as lots of philosophers have, it's an ancient British tradition, and even people like, I mentioned Frédéric earlier, and even people like Frédéric started from that place. Mm. He certainly wasn't a theist at all, but he started from that place of saying, I suppose, to put it in traditional British terms, that all knowledge begins with ideas or perceptions, sense perceptions in particular. Mm. And if you start there, it's quite natural to think, well, the theory that there is a material world which exists even when we're not sensing it or experiencing it is precisely that. It's a theory.
Yes.
I mean, I don't doubt it for a moment.
No one does, really.
I philosophically doubt it, but I don't really doubt it. There is a material world. But if you ask the question, is the material world like the one that we see and feel and hear and touch? It seems to me the answer is almost certainly not. And, David knows much more about philosophy and science than I do, and I used to send my pupils to David when I was in Cambridge to learn about these things. So what I say is subject to what he comments on it. But I think when you read quantum physicists these days or see them on television, they tend to say, oh, we live in an 11-dimensional, wave-particle duality sort of world, and it's very different. So the brain constructs the world of sensations. Now, I would then just qualify that by saying I think the brain is important, but if you start from the experienced world, you're not starting from that world of 11-dimensional.
No.
What quarks, whatever they are going around. So it's a very different world, and I would say my starting position is, I think, that nothing can take away from the reality of perceptions and thoughts and sensations and feelings. And they're primary. That's where your knowledge starts from. Mm. And the existence of a world beyond that, though it's very well evidenced indeed, very good reasons for believing it, is a theoretical construct.
Yeah.
So that's where I start. So that experiential reality is the foundation of reality, and nothing can undermine that.
And David, you want to come in already, so go ahead and we'll come back to Keith.
We're going to have to move on quite quickly, because I don't think there's anything that Keith said so far that I want to disagree about. I mean, not in the science. I mean, I think, of course, in investigating the world, we start with experiences. We start with how things strike us and try and figure out on the basis of that where what else there is. Keith seems to think that a materialist wants to deny the existence of experiences. Certainly not. I mean, of course they're experiences. I mean, I think, as it happens, they are one and the same as certain processes going on in my brain. But I don't want to deny the existence of conscious experiences and feelings and so on. And indeed, when we're investigating the world, that's where we start. Doesn't mean that in the order of metaphysics, of reality, that those are the fundamental things. The fact that epistemologically, in the course of investigation, we start there, it doesn't mean that when we end up with our final view about what reality contains, we have to regard those as the fundamental things. But there, you know, Keith didn't say that in the nature of reality, experience is the fundamental things either. He agrees, of course, there are tables and chairs, and I presume atoms and electrons outside the conscious experience of people. And so I don't see that so far we've got any
Okay. Well, where is the disagreement then, gentlemen? I mean, how does this lead on to, in a sense, for you, giving us evidence for a non-physical aspect to ourselves, Keith?
Well, maybe we get a difference if I go on to say what I think experiences are.
Go ahead.
And I do think, in the classical Cartesian, Descartes thought up this classical distinction between mind and matter, as he put it. And the thing about mental realities like thoughts or feelings or mental images is a good example, I think, are not locatable in public space. So that's one fact about them. They are private in the sense that only I know that I'm having them. If I call up a mental image now, you don't know what it is, but I know what it is. So there's some knowledge that nobody else has access to. So the privacy of knowledge, for me, is partly the definitive mental experience. And the other major thing that is also Cartesian, comes from Descartes, is that if they're not in public space, they, as Descartes put it, they don't have extension. The two things are privacy, private access, and extension. I don't pretend philosophers haven't discussed these a great deal, but I still think that these are marks of mental phenomena.
I mean, if I can boil this down a little for those who aren't familiar with the area, but would this include the sort of the sense that when we see a red apple, as it were, the sensation we have of a red apple is qualitatively different to what's going on in the brain, the physical processes that are happening, the synapses that are firing, that are presumably producing this thought of a red apple. But the two, now you've said, David, for you, it's one and the same thing.
Good, exactly.
For you, it is not one and the same thing,
no,
presumably.
I think philosophically, I don't think I can make sense of saying that some brain process, which is in public space and is publicly observable, is the same thing, is identical with some experience that I have that nobody else knows anything about. I can't see that as a sense of identity.
Okay, so that's exactly what I think. Michaelis is committed to saying that experiences, the visual experience of a red apple, is one and the same as a certain material state or material process. And let's just say it's a brain state or brain process. I mean, there's various further options that might involve more than just your brain, parts of your body. Some people think even the external world. But let's just say it's one and the same as a brain process. Well, then you're committed to, well, yes, it is in space and time. It's got a certain location. But that's not so crazy. I mean, presumably my experiences are something to do with my body, my eyes, and not yours. They're over here rather than over there. They're private. Well, they're going on in my head, and so I have ways about knowing about them that you don't. So to that extent, I don't see that there's any insuperable difficulty here in identifying the experience with the brain process. It seems to me that on your side, though, you do have some nasty difficulties if you want to distinguish them. I mean, you're quite right. I mean, the issue is, I want to say that there's nothing more than the brain processes. There are experiences, but the experiences are just certain brain processes. You want to say, well, of course, it's the brain processes and so on. But in addition, there are these extra things, the experiences, the thought and feelings. The problem that I think faces your view, and this is the problem that persuades me of materialism. I wasn't always a materialist. As I said, when I started off in philosophy, we were all kind of half idealists in the 60s. We started with experience, and we tried to build the world out of experience. A.J. Ayer, despite being an atheist, was also a phenomenalist, a species of idealism. But what persuaded me of materialism was the difficulty of understanding how an independent, a separate mental realm of the kind that Keith wants to endorse can make any causal difference to what goes on in the physical world. I want to say that my experiences, thoughts, feelings, decisions and so on affect the physical world via affecting the movements of my body. I mean, of course I want to say that. We all want to say that. I don't have any difficulty in understanding how they do have such an effect, because I think of them as just physical processes. But it seems to me that Keith does have a difficulty in explaining
how... There's a sort of explanatory gap here. If this realm did exist, how it would interact with, have an effect on the physical realm.
Very good.
And so, Keith, do you have an explanation for that, or is that just simply one of those mysteries that we don't necessarily get?
Well, I think the strong argument for me is the argument of identity. How can a thing which is non-spatial, apparently, and private and not publicly verifiable be identical with something which has all those properties? How can it be the same thing? So that's the problem of identity. Yeah. But now the other problem, which is a hard one for me, is how can these mental events, which are not in space, which are not physical, interact with the causal network of things in space? How can that interaction happen? I agree, that's the hard problem for somebody who's not a materialist. But I think it's just a hard problem. The fact that it's a problem doesn't—it's not a knockdown.
No, it doesn't sort of take away from the fact that you've also posed a problem to David of your own kind.
This is where perhaps I could refer to God. It's not going to impress David very much, but God. Obviously, people believe. Many philosophers have believed that God is a spiritual being, not a physical being, who creates the universe. So there is a form. Possible, logically possible form of causality between purely immaterial entities, spiritual entities like God, and physical entities. So that is a possibility, though it wouldn't come within the ambit of physical law.
Yeah, I mean, in the sense, are you saying, David, we've got no previous experience or nothing we could scientifically look at in the way that we can with physical cause and effect between an immaterial cause and effect? And so it's just a kind of hanging there, we just don't know how this would happen if it did exist, sort of question.
No, let me make clear the worry that I said was what persuaded me and seems to me the most persuasive argument for materialism. It's not that I can't make sense of the idea of an immaterial realm affecting the material realm. It's not that I can't make sense of the idea of omniscient God creating the physical world, or indeed of a separate mental realm as posited by Descartes affecting the movements of my body. It makes perfectly good sense. I mean, some people say, how can one realm affect another? But we have plenty of examples of that. I mean, electromagnetic radiation affects the motion of matter. They're two different kinds of realm, but they influences on each other. There's no great conceptual principle difficulty there. It just seems to me that the scientific evidence, and it's, to my mind, fairly recent scientific evidence, argues that there aren't any such extra physical influences on the physical realm. I mean, I think the history here is very interesting. As I read the history, I'm taking a kind of philosophical view in which modern means anything after 1600. The recent history of scientific thought has not been anti-materialist. Most classical Newtonian scientists, until I'd say about 100 years ago, took it to be completely obvious that there were external mental forces influencing the physical realm. And while that's not now popular view, in fact, is in scientific circles very much a minority and perhaps even cranky view, I think the reason is that there's been lots of investigation of exactly what goes on in the brain, and there's no evidence for any
but then scientists aren't always philosophers, and in that sense, Keith, you're all for modern science, aren't you? I'm sure neuroscience and what we know about the brain and everything else, but it hasn't persuaded you that the brain is nonetheless just the only physical thing producing this effect of the mind.
No. I mean, I think it's important to say this argument has real implications, everyday real-life implications, particularly for matters of legal responsibility and guilt and punishment. And in English law at the moment, people have to be found guilty of when they do something wrong, and that means they have to have been able to do otherwise, and they had to do what they did, knowing what they were doing freely. And, of course, there are legal theorists who want to say we should abolish talk about guilt and this, because if people aren't free, if what they do is in accordance solely with physical laws, then responsibility and guilt have no further place. And I'm persuaded by that. I think that's true. If I were a materialist, that is a person who thought now defining this rather narrowly, as a person who thinks every causal influence has to be a physical one, and has to proceed in accordance with predictable or at least statable, or describable laws, which are purely physical, so that the mind or my intention to do something doesn't insert a separate additional influence onto this. I would actually change my view of the law and of responsibility. So it's not just religion at stake.
It would have significant implications. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back in just a moment. Lots of interesting issues already rearing their head in terms of, does materialism mean an end to free will, and does that change what we do with our ethics and everything? It's amazing how these philosophical areas spill into each other. But today, the core question we're asking on the programme that aims to get you thinking, and certainly aiming to get the grey matter thinking today, is our mind more than matter? So join me again in a few moments' time as we continue this conversation between Keith Ward and David Papineau.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities. You'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for your support.
At the same time, when I think, when I have a thought, I'm going to, I intend to reach my hand out and pick up my cup of tea. I sometimes wonder, well, that's me telling my body to do something. And so is there a sense in which there's a problem there for the physicalist about the fact that this kind of mental sort of thought, which doesn't seem to have a sort of physical embodiment, then produces a physical reaction, presumably? I mean, I am the novice in this area, so put me right.
You and Keith both keep assuming that if it's your brain, it's not you, it's not thoughts, it's not feelings. No, you are the sum of certain kinds of activities, conscious activities, deliberate activities in your brain, and that's what you are. And so, of course, it's you affecting your body and your decisions and your movements and so on. So that's all fine from the materialist point of view. Keith switched. I mean, we might want to come back to this from the problem I was pressing, that if you're immaterialist, it's very hard to see how your decisions to be made can make a difference to your bodily movements. He switched from that to the thought that if you're a materialist, well, then everything will be determined, and therefore there's no free will, and therefore guilt and responsibility. And he said that he thought if he was a materialist, then all these things would follow: no guilt, no responsibility, no free will. But I think that's his problem. Again, just as I don't want to deny selves or consciousness, thoughts and feelings, I don't want to deny free will either. I think that I act freely when my bodily actions are a result of my conscious deliberations and decisions. And when people so act freely and do something bad, they should be held responsible. I mean, I don't want to rule out the possibility that really understanding the nature of people might make us have a somewhat different view about what kinds of punishment are appropriate, what the rationale for punishment is, and so on. I mean, that's a complicated and delicate issue, but I certainly don't want to deny that people are responsible for what they do in certain circumstances. In other cases, people aren't responsible. But when they act as a result of deliberation, in full awareness of what they do, and perform some action, they should be blamed or possibly praised for what they do.
Did you, in that sense, duck the question then, Keith, or is is this problem that it then presents for you a good reason to reject a physicalist view of the brain?
Well, I didn't mean to duck the question, but it's true I changed the issue slightly just to point out what, to my mind, some of the implications would be if you could give a completely physicalist causal account. But let me return to that, then. We're going to get every philosophical problem in the universe. the problem at this point is causality. Yeah. What is the nature of causality? Now, honestly, I don't think anybody knows in the end, and it's still a hugely controversial topic. So first thing I would say, there isn't a generally accepted philosophical doctrine of what causality is and what sorts of causes there can be. To take a little example, we might have thought causes are like mechanical pushers and where one thing impacts on another, but we wouldn't talk about causality like that very often now in physics. And you talk about fields and all sorts of strange forms of causality. So my case is a case for agnosticism on this.
Okay.
And the case is that we don't know what sorts of causes there could be or what the limits of causality are. We're only at the beginning of finding out the forms of causality there are and what impact antimatter might have on matter. We hardly know anything about it. So I just don't think we know enough about it to say that all causes have to be of a physical material sort.
But I'm afraid there I agree again. It depends on the force of the can there, but I agree that causality is not very well understood, and I didn't hinge my earlier arguments against dualism on the idea that it made no sense to suppose that a material thing could influence the physical world. I think it makes perfectly good sense. I mean, I'm quite open about the possibilities for different kinds of causation. My worry is that when we look at the empirical facts, we find no evidence that in reality there are causes apart from the physical causes. Let me put the issue like this. Physicists think they have a list of the fundamental forces, and nowadays we think that there's gravitational force, there's the strong nuclear force, weak nuclear force, electromagnetic force, four forces. 200 years ago, physicists thought there were a lot more forces. They thought, in addition, there were chemical forces, there were forces of friction, they thought there were vital forces, and they thought there were mental forces. And modern physics has cut down the number of forces. Now, on Keith's view, it will be the case that if we look into the brain, a thought experiment, we will sometimes find atoms accelerating and changing their motion in a way that can't be explained by the four fundamental forces, but which can be explained by an extra mental force. And this is a rather strong claim to be making. And I mean, if a physicist really believed what you thought, they ought to be doing experiments. I mean, they get a Nobel Prize pretty quickly for finding that there's an extra force operating in the brain. And so my view is that we have not conclusive, but strong empirical evidence that there are no such forces. Modern philosophical materialism became as prominent as it is in the middle of the last century, and it was just about the time that Huxley and Hodgkin analysed the workings of nerve cells and the transmission of electrochemical messages across nerves, and showed that this could be understood all in electrochemical terms. And I don't think it's any accident that it was at that point that philosophers decided, well, the idea of an extra mind making a difference in the brain has been ruled out empirically, not conceptually. It's not that it's incoherent. It's just that there's no evidence for it, I'm afraid.
I mean, do you feel at all the force of Keith's argument that of this non-identity of the qualia we have, as it were, the sensations we have, and what is actually happening on a physical level? That, I mean, in a sense, it sounds to me like you're saying we have to be agnostic as to how that arises. You know, perhaps further research will help us. Keith, on the other hand, is saying we have to be agnostic about how this immaterial part of us operates on the mental, on the physical. So, I mean, are you both just sort of taking different positions and then saying, this is my area of mystery, this is my area of mystery?
Let me just say something. I don't want to go on too long. Keith wants to get in here. But on the what Keith called the identity problem, I agree that it's somehow counterintuitive to suppose that the experience of seeing a red apple might be one and the same thing as a brain process. In addition, there's some powerful, persuasive philosophical arguments we haven't discussed here by many philosophers who say it can't be right that because of the privacy or the lack of spatial... They're so different they couldn't possibly be the same thing. I've written lots of things saying, no, those arguments are no good. We've really got to come to terms with the fact they are the same thing. But just to get the logical geography here, it's quite striking that many of the philosophers who are persuaded by these abstract anti-identity arguments that they can't be the same thing are also persuaded by the Hodgkin-Huxley consideration that the mind can't make any difference in the brain. And so, unhappily, they end up as epiphenomenalists. They say there is this extra stuff, but the physical realm is causally closed, it's sufficient unto itself, and so this extra stuff doesn't make any difference. Mm. And, I mean, that's a position that you don't really want to end up in, and Keith certainly...
No, I don't want to end up there. I agree, it's quite widely held, that view. I think there's a slight oddity about it, even though it is quite widely held. And the oddity is that I'm tempted to say that if something is real, it will have causal influences. And so to say that something is real, i.e. epiphenomenal, it just sort of comes out of the brain somehow, but it's different from the physical brain, has different properties, but has no causal influence, is a bit odd, I just think. But reality and causality have a close relationship. I find epiphenomenalism rather odd, and I would rather go for materialism if I was going to make that choice. The argument that a neuroscientist can give a closed causal description in principle of everything that happens in the brain, and this it would leave nothing left over for anything else to be there, that would be very disconcerting. In fact, I think it would be a disproof of my position. I've just said it can't be done. So David says there's no evidence. But actually, the evidence in these cases, this is where you go back to where does our knowledge begin? It begins with experience. And the evidence is the evidence of experience. Namely, I know that I can raise my arm when I want to, and that I am intending to do that. More seriously, in mathematics, when you go through a mathematical argument, you come to a correct conclusion. To say that that has come about because of the operation of physical laws, not logical laws, but physical laws, just strikes me as deeply counterintuitive.
It raises this question of whether a view of our brain, which essentially makes it deterministic, where there isn't a free will,
and it is physically deterministic.
Does it do away with rationality, with logic? We just arrive at the beliefs we have because we've been causally determined by our physics to do that. Then we're not actually thinking. We're not actually making a decision on the basis of our free will having weighed the evidence in that sense.
That's good.
Can I just grab onto something that Keith let slip a moment ago? He said it's the determinism that's a problem here, not the physical determinism. And let me just point out that there are various versions of dualism that will generate just the same problems of free will and is mathematical reasoning rational. If you're a determinist dualist, then you'll have problems with free will and rationality just as much as a determinist physicalist. So it's really determinism is the issue we're worrying about here rather than materialism.
Yeah, it is, but the reason it's come up is because of saying there is a deterministic system which is purely physical and doesn't require anything else, really.
Yeah, I agree in this context. The dualists are going to be non-determinists and the physicalists are going to be determinists-ish.
I suppose the philosopher Immanuel Kant is the person whose system is probably not, in the end, not satisfactory in itself. But he proposed that when you couldn't make a theoretical decision between two difficult problems like determinism and free will, then your practical experience, you had to make a moral commitment. I have a lot of sympathy with that. I think that we believe that we do things and that we could have done something different. We didn't have to do it. What we did was wrong. It was our fault. It really, the buck stops with me and not with my brain. So I'm not identifying myself with my brain. I'm saying the buck stops with something that could have done otherwise. My brain, so determinism is relevant here. My brain, as far as I can see, couldn't have done otherwise because it's physical laws. But even if it could have done otherwise, that physical law wouldn't operate as something which gave me responsibility. Can I just distinguish between causes and reasons? Here's another huge philosophical area. That physics deals in causes. It doesn't deal in reasons. It doesn't deal in, hasn't since the 16th century dealt in things which happen for the sake of some outcome.
In the sense that you would distinguish between, I got up in the morning because my limbs moved to the edge of the bed and I got up and etc. That's, if you like, a physical causes view.
Yes.
The reason I got up was because I wanted to go and make myself a cup of tea.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
That's the difference. I mean, what does that have to say to David, though? Do you think that his
reasons do have a causal influence, although they're not causes in the physical sense. They're not things which say if X, then Y, and that's a general law which applies to everything. So they're not like that.
The purposes, the reasons we have, can't be boiled down to a sort of physicalist description.
Well, so you say, but of course, that's what I
don't know.
We keep coming round to this issue. I mean, Key says, well, you know, if the cost of materialism is to give up free will, to give up reasons and so on, well, then we should choose not to be material. I'm happy to concede that for the sake of the argument. I mean, if I either had to give up materialism or deny consciousness, or I either had to give up materialism or I would give up materialism. But I don't see that's a choice. I think that all these things, consciousness, free will, doing something otherwise, reasons, are accommodatable within a materialist worldview. I mean, on reasons, I've spent a large part of my intellectual life trying to explain how we can understand representation, how we can understand there being mental states, which I think of as brain states, which are about something else and which aim for certain ends. And such an interesting project, a difficult project about how a materialist should understand those things. But my aim is precisely to understand those things in materialist terms, not to deny them. So, of course, I will say, among the causes, among the things that influence my body, some of them are reasons. Some of them are mental states which represent this action as having a certain outcome and lead me to do it because that's what they represent. And I don't want to deny that there are such purposes, goals, ends to my actions. I just want to say all that can be understood in materialist terms. So similarly with the mathematician. I mean, the mathematician goes through certain brain processes, but we can also consider the question of whether these brain processes are good for getting at the truth about the subject matter that the mathematician is interested in. And again, a materialist can't be precluded, or I say doesn't get precluded, from seeing things in those terms.
Would you accept a distinction between two sorts of materialism, two broad sorts? One is we could call perhaps reductive materialism, which says you can get rid of all consciousness, or you can get rid of logical thought, etc. Yeah. Intentionality, that's your thoughts being about something. And that sort of materialist is a very hard line and would say, yes, you can stop talking about pains and things like that if you want. A more inclusive materialist or a non-reductive materialist. I don't know if you're happy to.
I certainly think we want to make that distinction, but the distinction is normally made the other way around. The good people are called reductive materialists. The bad ones are the eliminative materialists. So and when it comes to consciousness and the rest, there are very few eliminative materialists. I mean, all the materialists. I mean, nobody wants to go around saying there are no pains, there are no thoughts, there are no feelings. Of course there are pains, thoughts and feelings. And so nobody wants to eliminate those things. They want to reduce them, explain how they're present in the...
But they are ultimately reducible in that sense to a precisely physical causal sort of, you know, definition. in the sense, I mean...
OK, I'm going to... No, we don't want to get bogged down in philosophical terminology. Having said that, there's eliminativists who want to get rid of the good things. There are the reductivists who want to say they're still present in the physical world. But now, among philosophers who work on this, we now get a division among the reductivists, some of which want to be rather crude and say pains are one and the same as your C fibers firing and identify the pains with some very specific physical processes, and others who are a bit more nuanced, wishy-washy, and they say, no, we can't identify being in pain with any specific physical process. There's some rather more structural account of what's going on, and we want to identify the pain with the structural. And now, and this I'm sorry, nobody's going to be able to follow this terminology, but among the philosophers, among the people I've been calling reductionists, the wishy-washy ones are sometimes called non-reductive physicalists. And the more hardline ones are reductionists. But none of them are eliminativists. And so we can all agree that the eliminativist view, the view that says there are no pains, there is no consciousness, there is no free will, that's not a good option. And I'm not interested in exploring that option at all. I'm the kind who wants to explain how all these things, value, free will, consciousness and so on, are available within a purely materialist world.
And are you, David, a wishy-washy materialist?
I have no strong feelings about it. I mean, there's cases and cases. There's cases and cases.
I could be,
yeah.
I mean, it sounds, though, from everything that has been said here, Keith, that you reject David's view, but firstly on the basis that you don't find that there is an identity between the senses and the mechanics of the thing. Secondly, though, because of the implications of if it were a physicalist world we lived in, it could not account for the sense you have of morality, of free will, of rationality, that these things wouldn't stack up if we lived in... But you're obviously taking a very different view of what physicalism would entail than David does, who says we wouldn't need to make all of those radical assumptions.
I can accept this. In fact, there are quite a lot of Christians who are non-reductive physicalists. Mm-hmm. It's a possible position. Yeah. I think that what concerns me most really about the whole debate is what is important about a human person. In the end, it's an ethical issue that concerns me. And I think what is important about a human person for me is two types of things. One is the uniqueness of a person's personal experience, which nobody else can ever access or know fully about. And that uniqueness gives each person a unique sort of status in reality. And the other is responsibility, that people are responsible for their actions. Now, if a non-reductive physicalist can take account of these, I probably don't have much trouble with that. I mean, the dispute would then be partly terminological. Yeah. I don't want to say that minds can just hover around without any bodies.
No.
I don't want to say that.
Right.
No. Mm-hmm. And I don't think...
But isn't that,
about
in
Christians,
a sense...
I don't think Christians want to say that.
If we believe in God, we're talking about an immaterial force without a physical presence necessarily.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, in the case of God, you certainly are. But I presume we're not directly talking about God.
No, we're not. It's not a concept that's, in that sense, doesn't make sense to you, though.
I think we're both agreed it's a logical possibility. Yeah. I think even AJA, before he died, or after he died, you might say, after he was clinically dead and came back to life again, thought that God was a logical possibility, which is a big change for him.
Yes,
he had thought God didn't make any sense at all. And latterly he said the idea of a God does make sense, but it's just, again, there's no evidence it's not a...
I mean, coming back to you, Keith, the fact is that when people take mind-altering substances or have an accident which affects the brain or a brain disease, things about their character often do change. The physical has an effect on our mental states. That, for a lot of people, is ample evidence that it is about the physical aspect of us that is all there is, and that's what's affecting the mental state, so there's nothing independent.
Okay, can I at this point introduce my favourite quotation from Descartes? It's from the Sixth Meditation. He's well known as the father of dualism, but in fact what Descartes said was this, this is in English, of course, that the mind is not lodged in the body as a sailor or a pilot is lodged in a ship. It is not, but it is inextricably interfused with it so as to form one thing. Mm-hmm. So even Descartes is not the sort of dualist who says minds and bodies are just contingently, accidentally connected from town to town. You know, so obviously the mind, mental states are embodied, fully embodied, to form one thing. And the analogy I would tend to use there is water. And you say water is H2O, and that's two things in a sense, but they form one thing when they fuse together to form H2O, water. I think that was Descartes' view, and it's the one I want to hold.
This may not be something that David could comment on, but what does that mean for the Christian view of, say, the afterlife? Does it mean that we will have some, if we do have an afterlife, physical aspect to that afterlife? A lot of people think it's just the immaterial soul is sort of set free from the physical body.
Well, they shouldn't think that. That's not a Christian view at all, actually. There's no trace of that anywhere in the Bible, either Jewish or Christian.
Because it talks of the resurrection.
Yes, the resurrection of the body, yes.
So in that sense,
we've got problems about what sort of body, but that there is some sort of physical embodiment is quite clear. I mean, the crucial question then, from the religious point of view, is not really the question, is the mind going to exist without the body, where mind equals soul in this context? It is, could the mind exist without this body, but in some other body? Because presumably the resurrection body is not going to be identical with any state of this physical body.
It raises another interesting question. Perhaps we'll have to leave it till the next section as we come to the end of the show. But from your point of view, David, could a complicated machine essentially come to be like a human in the sense of, if we are, at the end of the day, physical things, could we, you know, if technology allowed us, build a robot or whatever that could experience all the things we do, including these perceptions we have that seem to be so different to the physical components that would make up that robot? But is that, in your view, theoretically possible?
I think yes. They're interesting questions about what exactly it takes to make a conscious being. I mean, do we just need to make a being with the same kind of mental structure as us, or do we have to have a being that's made of the same kind of chemical components? I mean, in Star Trek, what Star Trek version 2? I'm only original Trekkie, but I understand there's this character called Commander Data, and he's, you know, he's a very fancy computer, so he's like us down to a fine level of detail, but it's made of different components. And is he conscious or not?
Well, these are often the questions they deal with in a popular way on the.
But I think if we actually did have such a being and interacted with it, and it was sufficiently like us, we would have no doubt that this was a person.
We would accord them human rights and all the rest of it.
Well, of course. If they were sufficiently like us, it would be unnatural for us not to treat them as
we are going to have to go to that break. I've introduced a big biggie there before having to cut it off short. But so, Keith, I asked the question before I had to draw it to a close of David just a moment ago. An advanced robot, could you get to a sort of equivalent of a human in the sense of having senses, consciousness in that sense? Do you think that's possible? Is it?
Well, when you say, is it possible? I don't know whether it's physically possible. I think it's logically possible. I think it could happen. It wouldn't.
So on your view, would it happen? Because obviously you do believe there is an immaterial. We can't create, in science, immaterial substance. Is that something that, as it were, is imposed, presumably from an outside source? Because you don't sense, from what I'm gathering, you're not saying it arises from the physical in that sense.
Well, I do think that the mind or the soul arises from the physical, yes. I don't think it's wholly accounted for in terms of physical, but I hold a supervenience view, that is, if you get the physical structure right, you're going to have a mind.
Right. Okay.
I do believe that.
So you do believe that. So yes. In that sense, in what sense then, I suppose I'm asking you from a Christian point of view, Is it important? Does consciousness make a difference, as it were, to our value and to everything else? A lot of people would say consciousness is what separates us from the rest of nature. Yes. That this is something that God intended, that God especially created for humans.
But again, can I stress that for me, this is primarily a set of moral questions, but they're metaphysical too, because it's about what's the nature of a human being that makes a human being important, if we are important and distinctive from every other animal that we know about. Is there such a distinction? What could it be found? Well, that's my the question that pressures me. And I think it's important. Take Alzheimer's, for example. Somebody with Alzheimer's, they lose all their memories. Mm. And you say, well, that's because of the structure of the brain and what's happened to the brain, and those neurons aren't firing anymore, so they don't have their memories. And the question is, have those memories gone forever? That's it. So if you have immortality, what happens? Mm. And so my interest there is to say, no, those memories haven't gone forever. They just cannot be accessed because the brain is the means of access to memories. So I wanted to say, well, memories aren't identical with physical structures in the sense that if the physical structure disappears, the memories cannot exist. They are logically separable. Even if they are in some sophisticated sense identical, which I'm not very happy with, but if they are, I still want to say, but they're separable. So those memories could exist without that precise physical structure. And I think that's, for me, quite an important concept.
But I'm wondering how much of a dualist Keith really is. I've been worrying since you gave the water H2O analogy, and you said, well, it's like that, the mind and the brain. But water and H2O just are one thing described in two different ways. I mean, it's not like the H2O generates the water or causes the water to appear. It just is. That's what water is. I mean, brain process is just what our feelings are. And with the memories, I mean, so I would agree as a materialist that you would have the memories again if you had the right kind of physical structure to constitute them. But I take it you don't think in the unfortunate Alzheimer's patient that the memories are present somewhere at the time when there's no physical structure subvening them. Right. So I'm
wondering, what's the difference?
Yes. Can I raise a different
go on then
issue? Because a couple of times Keith has mentioned this is all a moral issue, and I was half anticipating a view that if you were an entirely materialist, there would be no morality, and I was going to come back, as I have with consciousness and free will and feelings and so on, and say, no, there's plenty of room for morality in a materialist universe. And I'm slightly curious that Keith hasn't pushed this line, but maybe he doesn't feel that materialism, that morality is a special difficulty for.
Well, it's only that if I were a materialist, I wouldn't be as wishy-washy as that, and I'd verge on the illimitative. So that's the way I see it, I suppose. But I'm not unhappy with this relaxed view that physical and. Mm. Or if you could put it like this, perhaps the mental is the inner side of the physical, of a complex integrated physical state in the brain. Mm-hmm. I'm not unhappy with that. What I think, and I thought this before I was religious, so it's not just a religious thought, is that there's nevertheless a logical separability of the inner phenomenal state from the physical basis.
A logical separability, yes, I agree about that. I mean, there did used to be materialists. Your old teacher, Gilbert Ryle, the logical behaviorist, maybe Wittgenstein, who argued that the idea of a being physically just like me but without any feelings was incoherent, that somehow, by definition, if something moved and talked like me, if it walked like a conscious being and talked like a conscious being, then by definition it was a conscious being. That's not my view. I think that conceptually, feelings are one thing and physical processes are another. It's just like water and H2O. I mean, it's not a a priori conceptual matter that water is H2O. It's a matter of scientific discovery that these things that you might have thought pre-theoretically were going to turn out to be two different things turn out to be one and the same. Temperature and molecular motion. Nobody until the 19th century, I mean, they knew about both things, but they didn't realize they were the same thing. So I think that, conceptually we can imagine coherently feelings without brains and brains without feelings, but it turns out under scientific investigation they turn out to be the same thing. So that's my view. So, I mean, we agree that logically, I mean, in the sense of can they be conceptually coherently separated, yes, of course.
Empirically, you don't think they are, in fact. Is that a problem?
Well, empirically, if you're talking about this world, I don't think they are either. But I think there are other worlds, there are other possibilities, there are other ways things could be. And as a Christian, I think there are. Can I say a word about the Christian
views? Please do. We'll have to call it to a close at this point, as you draw things to it.
Right, but just to say that if you look at the Bible, right, and you look especially at the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, there's nothing about a soul separate from the body there at all. There's not even a word for soul. And the words you might use are like nephesh, which is the breath of life. And all animals have it. Every living thing has the breath of life. It's not a specially human thing, even. So that's not a concept
for you,
that occurs in the Old Testament. And in the New Testament, the word is psuche, which is mind, word for mind. And again, as we said, the resurrection of the body. So it's quite important to see that the Hebrew view is actually not about a mind-body dualism in a very sharp sense, but it is that humans are made in the image of God, which I think refers to the capacities that humans have. Rather than a separate sort of thing. So maybe the biblical view is compatible with a non-reductive form of materialism.
Sure.
Although I admit I still am unhappy with it. But there we are.
for the reasons you've outlined in the show today. But thank you very much, gentlemen, both. It's been fascinating to have this discussion. And thanks for coming in, both Keith Ward and David Papineau.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed that discussion. Please let us know what you thought. Email us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or leave a comment on our Twitter account at unbelievablefe or on the Premier Unbelievable Facebook page. And do check out our website, premierunbelievable.com. That's premierunbelievable.com. Thank you for listening and see you next week for another Unbelievable Classic Replay.